Well, all indications are that along with the whiplash of climate change hitting the Arctic, activities of all sorts are picking up. Is this the moment for Alaska to seize its own destiny as the only Arctic state? I'm Steve Heimel. Have we become so accustomed to being marginalized, and are we really to be ready to be the center of the action? Our statewide phone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage, 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. On Talk of Alaska, the Arctic is again the subject statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the Federal Aviation Administration, providing information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, we're so used to being out in the hinterlands and an afterthought of the United States that it's very odd to think of ourselves being the center of the action. But I think in the future we are going to be the center of the action, and I'm going to make a case in the program today that we already are at the center of the action. It's the Week of the Arctic, and the Institute of the North is putting on this conference that they have done repeatedly in the past, putting forth the very same point that I'm trying to make, that we are the center of the action. And Week of the Arctic opened yesterday, and a number of people are involved in a discussion of the Arctic Council today, and probably my guest in the studio here would rather be there than here, but he's been willing to come in and join me today to talk about these issues of the North. Welcome to the show, Tony Pennicott.
I'm glad to be here, Steve.
Tony is the former premier of the Yukon Territory back in the 80s, and he led the New Democratic Party, which was sort of, I'd call it a leftist party, sort of pro-labor and like that, wouldn't you?
The New Democratic Party is a social democratic party. Canadian political parties are more like European political parliamentary parties than the United States. We have a two-party system. We have had a three, even five-party system in Canada for a long time. And we have a Conservative Party, which is what it says. And we have a Liberal Party, which is a center party in Canada. And the New Democratic Party, which is the number two party in our parliament, which is in European terms a social democratic party, with support from labor, environmentalists, women's movement, and people disproportionately in Western Canada, but also now Quebec. We have most of the seats in Quebec and from parliamentary seats in Quebec in the current parliament.
So you have become, you know, after you, I don't know how you ran your string out exactly in the Yukon Territory, but eventually you sort of went more into academia. You wrote a book on relations with Indigenous peoples, and you live in Vancouver now. You're a professional mediator, and you're a board member, I guess, for the advisory circle of the Gordon Foundation, kind of one of the guiding people of that that outfit, probably not well known to people in the United States, pretty well known in Canada. So you've moved, you've changed your focus, but you clearly have a very strong interest still up here in the North.
Oh, very definitely. And I'm in the last few months, I've actually worked in Alaska and the Yukon and the Northwest Territories and Nunavut, in Greenland and Norway, Denmark. Later in a few weeks, I'll be going to Finland and in Russia. So I've stayed connected with the Circumpolar North and a lot of the work I've done over the last few years, not just with the Gordon Foundation, which is a Toronto-based foundation that has put a lot of money into environmental, Indigenous, and Northern issues over the last few years. But I've been involved in a number of ways. I was, after being a legislator for the best part of 20 years, I then went on to become, and this is unusual in Canada, I became a bureaucrat. I was actually a civil servant in Saskatchewan and in British Columbia, where I dealt with some of the same kind of issues I dealt with in the North. And then later, I now am an adjunct professor at Simon Fraser University, where I teach in the public policy program. And I've taught at Queen's University in Ontario as well. And as you said, I've written about not just the treaty making of land claim settlements in the Canadian North, but also about the unfinished business in British Columbia. But also I've spent time in South America looking at indigenous, non-indigenous relationships down there too. So I've had a continuing interest, yes.
Well, that's going to be a fun conversation. So you're here for the Week of the Arctic.
Right.
It must be heartening to you to see the United States beginning to show at a federal level a little bit more recognition of international processes in the Arctic, in the sense of actually sending the Secretary of State to the Arctic Council, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. Drew Pearce, who's now the new chair of the Institute of the North, and who I knew as a legislator when we were doing annual exchanges with the Yukon
Legislature. That's right. You guys would go all the way back to that, wouldn't
yeah,
you?
We were both members of the legislature at the time.
Oh, yeah.
She mentioned the point that in this project that the Monk and Gordon Foundation have done, which is on the Arctic Security Project, which is a four-year initiative, we began with an opinion poll about the North and of the North by Northerners and Southerners in not just Canada, but also Norway, Sweden, Finland, Russia. We also did south of lower 48, the United States, about attitudes of the North. And she mentioned that while very few citizens of the United States would describe themselves as Northerners, most Canadians, even that 80% of the population who live within 100 miles of the American border, think of themselves as citizens of a northern country, of an Arctic nation. And so there's a kind of a northern consciousness. Now, it's true, we have three territories and 40% of our landmass in the north. And a lot of the romance and literature of Canada is about the north and, well, and its energy potential on one hand, but also the idea of this vast, some people would say wilderness, other people would say homeland of indigenous peoples, which is valued but not well understood, I would put it that way.
Well, yeah. I mean, you just look at how the population clusters in Canada, and it's just extremely interesting because, you know, all the populations to the south, there's far fewer people in the north, and they're, you know, except for the mining and so forth, almost all indigenous.
Well, not all indigenous. I mean, the majority of population in the Yukon is not indigenous anymore.
In the Yukon Territory.
And in the Northwest Territories, it's now, I think, closer to 50-50 than it was. But in Nunavut, 85% plus of the population are still Inuit. And that's not likely to change despite some major resource developments on the horizon.
Right. It's so, there's almost a, there's a, even though there's such similarity between U.S. and Canada, it's really a culture clash when you start talking about these issues, particularly relations with indigenous peoples, because they've been reacted to so differently by the official government. In Alaska, because they needed the pipeline, they made a settlement, a land claim settlement, and the result was these native corporations, which have both positive and negative results. Similarly, on the two sides of the border, we had this odd thing of boarding schools, mm-hmm. which what I think they call residential schools are called there, and essentially it was a mentality that was big in the 50s, and I think lingered longer in Canada than it did in the United States, that native cultures were going to go extinct, and that the younger generations needed to be assimilated, and so they should be pulled up from their villages and sent off and get about the business of assimilating. And now that thinking is reversed, and everybody's trying to backfill and figure out, well, what could, you know, if these cultures are staying alive, what can we do to help that? And this is difficult, wouldn't you say? You wrote a book about it. You know it's difficult.
It's difficult, but I think as a Canadian, I want to be careful not to be too glib about the differences. So in the 19th century, we both Canada and the United States made treaties with Indigenous nations. Many of those treaties were violated in terms of their promises about land and continued relationships. And in the United States, they created what were called reservations for Indians in Canada. They were called reserves. The residential schools, which we call in Canada, or church-run schools for assimilating people, was a reality in Canada right until the 1960s. And in Canada, we've recently gone through a process where a conservative prime minister has officially apologized for the residential school experience, the child sexual abuse and all the other horrors, the eradication of languages and culture that went on with it. But the assimilationist policy were slow to die. I think the real reckoning of the assimilation policy, which was intended to eradicate Indigenous identities, not just in Canada, the United States, but also Mexico, all of North America, obviously failed at the moment when, in quite recent times, people were asked in Mexico and the United States and Canada what percentage of the population were self-identified as Indigenous people. And at the end of the assimilationist policy, the number was far higher than it was at the beginning. So it was obviously a failure.
It's been growing, too.
Right. So it was a failure. And so there has always been, I think, though, certainly in Canada, maybe too in the United States, a mixed feeling about treaties. As a Canadian Indigenous leader once said, that for the government, treaties are a divorce. Whereas for First Nations, they see them as a marriage. They see them as creating a government-to-government relationship between an Indigenous community and their government and the national government, generally. Whereas other people see it as kind of a real estate transaction, a quit claim. Okay, we've decided you're left with this little bit of land, we own the rest, and that's a goodbye, and we'll go on to business. But that has changed. The treaties that Canada has been making, remember, this was unfinished business. Alaska was, treaties were ended. There was finished business, closed chapter in American history in the late 19th century after the Dawes Act. Until oil was discovered in Alaska, as you mentioned, and then in 68, I think it was, and then Congress rushed in to do the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 71.
Yes.
In Canada, was very much influenced. The Canadian Indigenous people were very much influenced by events in Alaska. So we had a Supreme Court decision around the same time, not 71, 73, called the Calder decision, which was a group in northwestern British Columbia, close to Alaska, the Nisga, went to the Supreme Court with their lawyer, Tom Berger, who later played a role in Alaska, review of the claims, to claim that their Indian land rights, their Indigenous title, as they called it, was still existing. And the Supreme Court had a split decision in 1973, which caused the Prime Minister of the day, Mr. Trudeau, to decide, well, the Indians had more rights than we thought we do. We need to go back to the treaty tables. So in northern Canada, northern Quebec, and British Columbia, where there were no treaties, they had to go back to the treaty table. The treaties that resulted were incredibly different from the 19th century treaties. So in the 19th century, the treaty commissioners arrive with a treaty already written up. You get this much land. The chief gets a cow. He gets a uniform, some farm implements. Sign here. Of course, the people couldn't read or write English. They often were just asked to sign with an X, and that was it. Well, the process in Canada was very different. It wasn't legislated settlement as it was in Alaska. It wasn't negotiation. In the case of the Yukon, a three-corner negotiation because the territorial government was a third party. They typically took, north of 60, 20 years for each treaty to be developed. The final result is not two or three or four or five pages. The Yukon Treaty, for example, is longer than the New Testament. And all the other treaties created north of 60 in the last, and some 20 of them, done over the last 40 years, are all long, complicated documents. And they deal not just with the amount of land that you get and the nature of the government you're going to exercise, but with detailed chapters on health and education and resource management and so forth. So just let me mention some of the things that evolved. The Yukon Treaty, for example, which covers 14 First Nations, the umbrella agreement, they have individualized versions of each of the treaties, and still two of them, or two or three of them, are not yet finally settled, is 41,000. You think you had 138 square kilometers for the indigenous people in Alaska. In Yukon, it was 41,000 square kilometers for 7,000 indigenous people. That 41,000 square kilometers is more land than in all of the reserves for a million Indians in southern Canada. So the scale is completely different. Also, even though the indigenous people in the Yukon are related, both the Tlingit and the Dene and the Athabascans are related to people in Alaska. Almost everybody has cousins. My children, for example, are members of the White River First Nation of Beaver Creek. Most of their relatives are in the Tanana Valley in Alaska.
Of course.
Right? So
that would be like Northway and Token.
Northway, Matasta, Tanacross, Copper Center, all those places. So the governance arrangements, the one thing they knew when they went to the table, that they did not want the Alaska corporate model. What they wanted was tribal government. And so what they got was tribal government in the Yukon, where the First Nations, individual First Nations, have actually, in terms of jurisdiction, more powers than the territorial government. Even today, though, 20 years after those agreements were made, the territorial government still has more money. So there's an interesting transaction where they haven't yet worked out, and these things will take a long time to implement, who's actually going to deliver what service in the community and how best and how most efficiently to do it. That stuff is all to come. But as very significant landowners in the territory, they're now big players in resource development and environmental decisions. We have in the Canada something that's evolved called co-management, where Alaska, you had this dispute about subsistence for a long time. Well, we had this problem in law which said the territorial government could regulate non-Aboriginal hunters in terms of giving licenses and setting harvest levels and all that stuff, while Aboriginal people, Indigenous people, could hunt and fish on unoccupied Crown public lands for fish and food, for subsistence. Well, we recognized at the negotiating table that having these two competing systems was bad for conservation, so we had to marry them. So we married them in the land claims agreements, the treaties, so that conservation had the first claim on the resource, subsistence users had the second claim, recreational hunters, in other words, your average person hunting for their moose in the fall, would have the third claim, and commercial users, the big game outfitters who'd previously been top of the food chain and had the first claim on the resource, now had the lowest claim. So that was revolutionary in terms of its impact, but it provided an integrated system which prioritized conservation, which was everybody thought was in the public interest.
And it's co-managed?
And that's co-managed. So at the community level, in the Yukon villages, an equal number of Native and non-Native people sit on a board and they decide the harvest allocation on moose and caribou and fish and all the other species.
Fascinating.
And those are aggregated into a territorial wildlife board where the minister responsible, what you would call the commissioner, has to accept the recommendations of the wildlife board unless he or she gives reasons in writing, which then create a public debate in the legislature and so forth. So there's a bunch of things that are different, but it was really a case of the Yukon and Northwest Territories, Dene, and Athabascans, learning from, and the Inuit, learning from the experience of what happened in Alaska to actually evolve the instrument a bit more.
Yeah, and we're still evolving.
Right.
Our guest is Tony Pennicutt, former premier of the Yukon Territory, now with the Gordon Foundation. And our telephone number is 1-800-478-TALK, 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Once again, we're on the endlessly fascinating subject of the Arctic and our place in it, the changing Arctic, and it's changing really fast. Today, or yesterday, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar talked mostly about oil and gas issues, but he did not miss the opportunity to leave behind some policy language, and I think it's interesting. I mean, he clearly, you know, you get a federal official comes up to Alaska. It's his first trip this year. He comes usually at least once a year, and he's got to talk to the Coast Guard. He's got to talk to all these different ones. And the science people. I mean, he's the big landlord of Alaska, and this is part of what he said.
You know, we are in the midst, in the Arctic, of a very dynamic situation where conditions are rapidly changing, in part because of the warming climate, the disappearance in many places of the permafrost, the erosion of coastlines at very significant paces never seen before. Alaska Natives will talk about that all the time, from Mayor Ita to others who I spent a lot of time with up there. But our own scientists are telling us that conditions are changing rapidly, including the way that the wind is blowing. And so the importance of science to guide our future decisions as a United States is very important. And that's why our Deputy Secretary David J. Hayes, who under the President's direction and my direction, has been moving forward to coordinate the science related to what we know about the Arctic so that we can understand these changing conditions. Obviously, there's a lot more to be learned about in the Arctic. Secretary Clinton and I were, for the first time in history, we had two secretaries attend the Arctic Council meeting because we recognize as well that it's more than just a United States issue. Canada is very involved, as is Russia, Norway, and other countries. Much of the research vessel traffic that we're seeing up in the Arctic seas is relates to vessels from many countries, including a significant presence from China and other countries that are out there looking at what is in the Arctic. And so it is very important for President Obama and for me to make sure that we are putting the whole of government behind understanding what is happening in the Arctic today, and that we are leading in the Arctic and not being left behind as these other countries move forward and pursue their own interests in the Arctic Sea.
And so you're hearing Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, and this was not accidental. What you're hearing here is basically an administration which is pretty far ahead of what's being talked about in Congress, and also pretty far ahead of maybe even the things that are constantly on our minds in Alaska. Now, that doesn't mean they get their stuff through Congress, but it means that they're thinking about it and they don't intend to be left behind. And he went on with that.
What both Secretary Napolitano and other of my colleagues in the administration have been doing is making sure that people are aware of the realities that we're currently facing in the Arctic. My understanding from Admiral Ostebo is that there were over 30 research vessels that were up there in the Arctic this summer, many of them still up there, that the traffic going through the Bering Sea, through the Bering Strait, is much increased over any other year, that adventure travel has become a huge issue, including cruise lines that are trying to make it up through the Northwest Passage. Those are realities that we face today, which the United States, as a whole of government, has not yet addressed in the full way that it needs to be addressed. And there are many aspects to it. For example, the Law of the Sea, the treaty which is so important to be signed off, which the President strongly supports, which you have great support from Republicans like Senator Lugar, as well as the leadership of Foreign Relations, Senator Kerry, that treaty should be signed off. It's frankly a terrible shame that it's only the United States that has not signed off on that treaty. But that treaty is so important for the United States from a national security point of view, but also for us as we work with the international community to deal with this very increased amount of traffic that we currently are seeing through the Bering Strait, as well as through the Chukchi-Beaufort seas, as well as into Alaska. I appreciate all of you being here today, and let me just close by saying that Alaska, this is my fourth trip to Alaska as Secretary of Interior. I have in other years been able to spend 4 or 5 days here. This year I was only able to spend all of Saturday and Sunday and this morning here, and I'm on my way out back to the mainland. But it is always an amazing thing for me to come to Alaska, because I think unless you are here and unless you know the great distances that the people in Alaska have to live with and the differences between the north and the south, the southeast, all the aspects of Alaska, you really don't get it. And so I hope that by my presence up here and Mike Poole's presence here in Alaska, that we're part of trying to educate the people on the mainland about the very important issues that face the people of Alaska. I stopped at a grocery store in Barrow simply because I wanted to see how the price of food is that the people of Barrow, many of the Alaska Natives who live in Barrow, what they have to pay for food. And I was taken a little aback when I saw that a gallon of milk is about $10. A loaf of bread is about $7. And it's very expensive. And some of those realities are realities that we need to make sure that the people of the mainland are very much aware of, because they're the realities that the people of Alaska have to live with every day.
So that was Interior Secretary Ken Salazar yesterday talking about Arctic policy in the midst of a news conference here in Alaska. And it was in 2007 when a Russian submarine went completely to the Arctic, to the North Pole, and put a little Russian flag in the seabed there. And American media took it rather like kind of a joke. They said it doesn't really mean anything. Russia then proceeded to march into an international border commission in Jamaica and make a claim on the North Pole, which they rejected, said, no, you have to go and do some mapping and stuff. And, well, you'll never guess what has happened since. Everybody is mapping. They're mapping like crazy. This is really going on. Sitting in the studio with me is Tony Pettiquet, former the premier of the Yukon Territory. Canada really had fits about this when Russia planted that flag. I remember this. All of a sudden, they're talking about putting a Coast Guard base up there. Isn't that native country up there now?
Well, it's talking about what would be people who live up there, the Nunavummiut, the people of the Nunavut Territory, who are mostly Inuit, as I mentioned before. This story did get a lot of headlines, but of course, some of us who know Artur Chilangarov, who planted the flag, and I remember him at the founding meeting of the Northern Forum here in Anchorage in 1991. In fact, I've seen him at many conferences since. He's a member of the Russian Duma. He's a serious oceanographer as an academic. He's also a politician. He once showed me one of his campaign posters for leaflets for running for his parliament in the Ruskin Duma in Siberia. And he had a picture of, I think, of a polar bear and one a dead polar bear under one arm. And I was saying that, you know, I'm not sure that in some parts of Canada that would actually get you elected anymore. The seriousness of the incident was, as you know, the response after that publicity stunt, which it really was that the five coastal states of the Arctic, not the Arctic Council, met in Ulusat, Greenland, to issue a declaration that offshore claims would be adjudicated according to the principles of the law of the sea, which, of course, as Secretary Salazar just happened to mention, the United States has not yet signed. But the language of that agreement was according to the principles of the law of the sea, not of the signatories. So there is a very legal process to resolve those. But you also know that as a result of their exclusion, the Inuit particularly got extremely upset. One of the achievements of the Arctic Council from its creation, since Gorbachev gave his zone of peace, the Arctic should be a zone of speech at Murmansk, and then Prime Minister Mulroney of Canada went on and helped create the Arctic Council. And Canada was the first chair, and the United States and Norway and Finland, Sweden and Denmark and Russia all became members. was the agreement that indigenous people, international indigenous organizations, the Athabascans, the Gwich'in, the Inuit, the Sami, the Aleut, and the Russian indigenous people would all have a voice in the Arctic Council, not a vote, but a voice. And so they would become permanently part of the dialogue, of the discussion. At Ulusat in Greenland, when they were discussing these offshore claims, the Inuit were extremely angry that they were not included in that discussion because that principle had been established in the Arctic Council, nor were three of the other members of the Arctic Council, interesting enough. So that set off a big debate about which was the more important body. Was it this Arctic Five body, talking about law of the sea principles, or was it the Arctic Council? And since then, all of the Arctic states have reaffirmed the primacy of the Arctic Council, the eight nations, with the indigenous people in the room, being part of the discussion. You began this program talking about, though, the importance of the Arctic and how central it is. One of the big issues facing the Arctic now is this problem of all the other people, nations that want to become members of the Arctic Council, China, India, Brazil, Singapore, the European Union. And there's very difficult policy questions to be resolved about whether they should become members or not. Mary Simon, former president of ITK, the National Inuit Organization of Canada, is fiercely opposed to those people becoming members because they think the indigenous voices will be swamped. Other people say if those people aren't part of the conversation inside the Arctic Council, they will go elsewhere, the United Nations or elsewhere, to actually try and influence Arctic policy. So it's a difficult debate to resolve, and that's one of the issues before the Arctic Council now. So it is important. The fact that everybody in the world wants to join this organization is a sign that the Arctic is on the front line. As somebody put it once, the Arctic is now hot.
Yeah.
And that's true.
And as Secretary Salazar will put it, that, you know, after just visiting, it's picking up more than we realize. And the strangeness of the climate warming and the natural forces is also picking up. There was this immense storm that happened up there. It has pushed the ice around in a way that nobody has ever seen before in living memory. And it just goes on. There's like we just seem to be, it's just the beginning, and there's more and more. So we have political turbulence, international relations turbulence, national turbulence, and cultural turbulence, along with all this natural turbulence. It's a very interesting thing for Talk Radio to take up as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Fall semester is just around the corner. Alaska Pacific University offers two-year, four-year, master and doctorate level programs committed to student-centered experiential learning. And there's no application deadline. Online education options are available in all undergraduate programs. For more information on how to obtain a quality and affordable education, visit alaskapacific.edu or call 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU.
Well, the subject is the Arctic. It is the Week of the Arctic right now in Anchorage. That is put on by the, what do they call it, the Institute of the North. And today they're speaking about the Arctic Council. And the events go on throughout the week, culminating with the film festival and the Robert O. Anderson Sustainable Arctic Award dinner and the Governor Hickel Day of the Arctic Champagne Toast. At the end of the week. It's a fascinating set of things that are going on. This Arctic Council discussion, as I understand it, is involving Julie Gourley, who is a staffer of the council, and is just, I wish I was there to hear what she has to say. With me is Tony Pennicott, the former premier of the Yukon Territory, and joining me by telephone now is somebody who started yet another conference, the Arctic Imperative Conference, Alice Rogoff, founder of the Alaska Dispatch. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with me, and I'm looking forward to this event because you're bringing in some heavy acts. You're bringing in the A-list for this thing, aren't you?
Well, that's our purpose, is to try and get the A-list of the United States to pay attention to Alaska as the representation of the U.S. as an Arctic nation.
And when I opened the show today, I was talking about the importance to Alaska, that maybe Alaskans, maybe this is the moment for Alaskans to realize that they're at the center of the action and see their own destiny. And I have a feeling that that's one of the messages you are putting out.
Well, very much so. Unfortunately, though, I think that the subject of which Alaskans are ready to do that is still a little bit problematic. I don't think that the people who live along the Bering Sea or the Chukchi or the Beaufort Sea yet have the levers at their disposal that they need to influence Alaska policy with respect to development of their shorelines and threats to their shorelines and threats to their subsistence. So part of what we try to do is to make sure that they are not just observers at this conference, but speakers on a level playing field with the heads of industry.
Yeah. Tony Pennicutt was talking about the co-management they have going in Canada. Of course, we're also getting co-management now, particularly with reference to, say, marine mammals and so forth. And I would say also that Secretary Salazar, who was just up here and speaking highly of David Hayes, who will be speaking at your conference next week, that he certainly seems to be cognizant that you're really not going to move Arctic policy without getting the indigenous peoples involved in a meaningful way.
Exactly. And I think that the challenge is to figure out what the legal, structural, administrative framework is for that to happen. You know, we're all aware that the Coastal Zone Management Program is gone and potentially at risk of not coming back. And that was a way of building in the participation of people whose shorelines were at stake. Well, without that, there is no other way for people who would like to have access to developing shore-based services, for example, for the Bering Strait, can call on their state to help direct resources their way. So I think that inside Alaska, that is really going to be the biggest challenge for the next decade, is how to figure out how the body politic of Alaska is going to come to grips with this question, whereas the same thing goes on a much bigger stage in Washington, D.C., where the U.S. Department of Defense has to be able to make a case to the budget green eye shade types, who, of course, we all need in an era of restraint, that money has to be allocated to the Western Alaska defense, where there is virtually none at this point. The U.S. Navy has said it's doing this pivot to the Pacific, but as far as I know, that is intended to mean to the South China Sea, and we need it to include a northern pivot to the Bering Sea as well.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because I don't see anybody from the Navy on your agenda there.
Well, we have General Jacoby speaking, and we have General Joe Ralston speaking, and they, I hope, are going to be free to speak for the entire defense establishment and its views of the priority on the Bering Sea coast.
I do know, and this has come up when we've done shows about the Arctic before, that the Navy keeps an eye on the Arctic. They send submarines around up there without, you know, anybody necessarily knowing about it.
And that's right.
And they've come out more in the open with a bunch of policy analysis lately that has largely been ignored. But the one outfit they can't ignore, the Navy's not ignoring it. And the military in general can't ignore it because there are enormous strategic considerations. And also, more practically, the Coast Guard can't ignore it, which is why Salazar was talking about Secretary Napolitano and why she came up here, because the Coast Guard actually has to deal with enforcing the oil leasing stuff, has to deal with whatever search and rescue or stuff might be involved with this increasing traffic that's going through there, and they don't even have a place to put a boat. I mean, they have to have shallow draft boats because there's no deep harbor, deep water harbor. And it seems like this is one of the areas where Alaska needs to get its act together and decide what it wants. In other words, if Alaskans decided, we think it ought to be at Cape Blossom, or we think it all ought to be in Nome, or we think it ought to be someplace around Barrow that has to be dredged all the time, whatever it is, if everybody got together about it, the Coast Guard would almost have to do it the Alaskans' way.
But that's a circular argument. Of course, you're right. But what is going to make the Alaskans make that choice is when the Coast Guard whispers in some well-placed ear in Alaska, the place we need is X. And we all know that the Coast Guard thinks that X is Port Clarence because that's where there is a natural deep water port. It was used hundreds of years ago by deep draft whaling ships to get out of the weather.
So I don't have my map here, but that would be what, to the Point Lay area? Where would that be?
No, it's south of that. It's 10 miles west of the village of Keller, which not coincidentally is connected to Nome by a road named the Bob Lodgett Highway.
Okay, so essentially it would be very close to the Bering Strait.
It is very close to the Bering Sea.
And on the south side of it.
It is a natural deep water harbor,
gotcha.
And it has a road connection to Nome. So if we're in the business of talking about roads to resources, that's one possibility, is that there be some connectivity from Nome to the rest of the state, either by rail or by road. But in any case, you know, that's a function of how quickly the sea ice is retreating. We all know this has been an anomalous year for ice in an awful lot of ways. But if the forecasts turn out to be true, it may well be that in the next 10 or 20 years, Nome will be ice-free for many more months of the year. Anyhow, I don't know what the answer is, and even if I did know, it's not up to me to wave the magic wand and decide. But I do know that Alaskans are going to have to face up to this one among themselves. Where do they want to see the port resources spent first? And does that also not mean that every village along the Bering Sea shipping lanes should have some emergency search and rescue and fueling facility, in which case, lo and behold, you actually have an economic development tool for some of those villages who are going to get the nasty side effects of shipping traffic anyhow. Maybe they could possibly get some positive side effects if we looked at it with some intelligent planning.
So how far do you think we'll get with this Arctic Comparative Conference? This will be the second annual, right?
Yes, and I know for a fact that there's going to be a presentation of a proposal to create a Bering Sea Port Authority as one method of governance by the state of Alaska to decide all these issues of where we put ports and what kinds of ports and how quickly they should begin. So that's a big step forward. That's Representative Bob Herron from Bethel who's putting that one out there. And I think that will probably become some of the grist for the forthcoming Arctic Commission of the legislature. So that's a big step. I also think that we are going to hear from the Department of Transportation about the study they haven't yet finished, but they're pretty close to, on determining where they see the greatest needs for transportation infrastructure along the Bering Sea coast of Alaska. So if you take all these, you know, pretty good clues to what the future has to look like, I think with each year we get a little bit closer to the point where a state legislature that wants to exert leadership and or a governor in his administration who want to exert leadership can seize this and say, here's our plan. Alaska, we're taking this bull by the horns, so to speak, and not waiting for you, the federal government, to tell us what to do.
Well, I look forward to it. Ellis Rogoff, thanks for joining us on the show.
My pleasure.
That's great. That's going to be the Arctic Comparative Conference. It's in, it's coming up in Girdwood, and it's going to be towards the end of next week. Meanwhile, it's already the week of the Arctic, and Tony Pennicott is part of that. And with us here in the studio, there's so many directions to go.
Well, let me just mention, you talked about Alaskans getting involved, and the big part of today's event at the Institute of the North is for a group of Alaskans who include members of the Senate and the legislature, as well as Julie Gourley, who is the senior Arctic official for the United States in the Arctic Council proceedings. What they're going to do is go through the kind of agenda that the Alaskans at this conference believe the United States should pursue when it takes over the chair from Canada in 2015. We had a conference in Toronto this year under the Monk Center for Global Affairs at the University of Toronto and the Gordon Foundation, for whom I'm an advisor, at Toronto to discuss reform of the Arctic Council. The Arctic Council, Canada was the first chair. They're now going to assume the chair for the second time as we've gone through a complete rotation of the eight nations in the 16 years since. And we went through a long process of developing background papers, having this conference in Toronto, which included, by the way, ambassadors from most of the Arctic Council's countries and diplomats from countries that want to become members, as well as indigenous people, industry leaders, government officials, and academics, all to talk about some of the tough issues. And if we've got some time, Steve, I'd love to just talk about a couple of them, because as they have bearings on Alaskans.
Absolutely.
Okay, so two of the big issues. The first is, I talked about the innovation of the Arctic Council to have permanent indigenous, international indigenous organizations, the Athabascans, the Inuit, the Aleut, the Gwich'in, et cetera,
right. Yeah.
As permanent participants with a voice. As the Arctic Council has evolved from a policy-shaping body into a policy-making body, for example, this past few months they made a decision on a joint initiative on search and rescue in the Arctic between the Arctic states, a big event. It's become clear that not all of the indigenous permanent participants can be fully effective participants in the work of the working groups of the Arctic Council. And this is because they don't have enough money for researchers, they don't have big enough travel budget, etc. So one of the big issues we were talking about in Toronto, what can be done about that? How can the Arctic states effectively support the work of the indigenous people so they are fully participating in that work? A related but not apparently connected question was this question of observers. So China wants in, India wants in, Singapore wants in, Brazil wants in, as the Arctic Council becomes more important. And as I mentioned, this is controversial for a number of the indigenous groups, but most especially the Inuit, who would prefer the Arctic Council to remain a kind of closed northern shop. And the other side of the argument is that if you don't include these powerful voices from elsewhere in the world, they will go elsewhere to have their influence on Arctic policy. So that's an unresolved debate. But two of the criteria that are articulated about whether you should be admitted as observers are, do you recognize the sovereignty of the eight Arctic states? One. And two, do you recognize the rights of the indigenous people in those eight Arctic states? And it is feared that some of the applicants would not pass that test. You'll remember, for example, the European Union was rejected as an observer because it would not support the seal harvest of the Inuit in northern Canada. So they have used their leverage in the Arctic Council to prevent an observer who might otherwise be an ally on some environmental or shipping or questions, climate change questions, to keep somebody out because they were not supportive or not respectful of the harvesting rights of indigenous people. There are lots of these questions that are going to be worked out. And as we get a body where you get some of the most powerful nations in the world want to participate, this is all the evidence you need, if you need it, that the Arctic has become central to the thinking about the planet's future.
So there's leverage as talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the Arctic. Tony Pennicutt's in the studio. We were earlier talking with Alice Rogoff of the Alaska Dispatch and Arctic Imperative Conference coming up, but more immediately, the Week of the Arctic, run by the Institute of the North, is going on. And someone said, did you mention movies? And I did. The Never Sets Film Festival is Saturday at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and they're renting the big hall, the Wendy Williamson Auditorium, but they're not telling us what they're showing. But I am confident that it will be Arctic-themed. And also coming up on Thursday, I wanted to mention the same issue that Alice was bringing up, the idea of putting together some sort of a port authority for the Bering Strait. And there will be a conference on that at the Week of the Arctic on Thursday at the Dena'ina Center. But it's by invitation only to participate, but the public is welcome to watch, which is how most of these things are being run. And it's going to be on the management authority of the Bering Strait. Army Corps of Engineers is involved, as well as Coast Guard and so forth. And, of course, you know, when you're talking about a port, you really do have to talk about the Corps of Engineers, because one thing that happens that when you look at the globe, it might not be completely apparent, is that most of these waters are really shallow. Because there's been all these glaciers that have filled up all the, you know, the oceans come up over a whole lot of sediments, and so you get water can be miles offshore and still only 50 feet deep or so. And Tony Pennicutt, you were telling me there's no port along the Arctic coast of Canada.
Well, Canada has an extremely long Arctic coastline,
yes,
as you can imagine, but we're actually the only Arctic state with no deep water port at all. And that's not just an accident of geography. It's a consequence of public policy that didn't make a priority of developing that kind of infrastructure. For a long time, Canada used to export wheat to Russia through the Port of Churchill, which is below the 60th parallel and in Manitoba. But at the Hudson Bay gave access to central Canada for Europe. And I would guess if you asked the business leaders in Iqaluit, the capital of Nunavut, they would probably like a port there, but it may not, for reasons you just talked about, be a perfectly suitable location. So this is an ongoing debate in the Canadian Arctic as well.
Yes, and even Hudson's Bay isn't all that deep, right?
No.
Yeah. And there was considerable Canadian saber rattling after the Russian flag placement, wasn't there?
Well, rhetorical saber rattling. I mean, in truth, Canada really only has two serious sovereignty issues. One over a tiny speck of land called Hans Island, and that's a dispute between Canada and Denmark about whether this would belong to Greenland, as Greenland is evolving, or Canada. And the combat so far has largely consisted of the Danes leaving bottles of their locally manufactured liquor on the island and Canadians reciprocating with Canadian whiskey.
Ah, like the old days.
Right.
Captain Cook goes over to Point Possession and piles up a bunch of rocks, puts a bottle of rum under there. The natives come over, take the bottle of rum. Everybody's been looking for it ever since.
But in the Beaufort Sea, which has been long been astute, I gather the Canadian government and the United States government have agreed to work together to find a resolution on that. So, and that is one that, as a former Yukon government official, that was one we always took a great interest in, because
But you know, they say they're working on it, but I don't see no work, and it seems like if you look at from the Alaska point of view, the border with Russia is totally a matter of settled treaty. There's no problem there, And it's said to me that the oceanographic work that's going out there and trying to figure out how far out you can extend under law of the sea, which the U.S. is doing madly, and I assume the Russians are, although I don't really know, essentially works to Russia's favor because the boundary is already settled. But you go to the other side over there, you know, after Barter Island and between there and Mackenzie Delta, and there's this huge disputed
wedge.
Well, and you say, oh, well, they're confident they're going to settle it. Wait a second.
Well,
now we know there's oil and gas there.
I'm assuming that neither country is interested in going to war over this. So
I assume.
And since the dispute arises out of the interpretation of a treaty, not between Canada and the United States, but a treaty between Britain and Russia in 1805 or 1825.
That's driving me crazy here, buddy.
That's the source document for this dispute. Now, I was at a conference here in Anchorage just a few months ago where some sensible adults from both sides of the border were actually in a conversation about this. So I actually believe, rather than picking up sticks or stones, that we will actually even get beyond name-calling to work out something on this one. Because it may be that the positions we were taking 10 or 20 years on that dispute are actually not sustainable.
Maybe they're not. So do you think Hillary knows about this yet?
I don't know that it's very high on her agenda, but as you mentioned earlier, it was good to see that she was attending Arctic Council meetings, had attended an Arctic Council meeting, and when she was last in Canada, she expressed herself on the Ulisat agreement, and there was a follow-up meeting in Chelsea, Quebec, by the same Arctic Five, and she expressed an opinion on that, which Canadians were pleased to hear. So we will watch all this with interest.
So are you having fun at the Week of the Arctic, Tony Pennicutt?
Yes, I am, because in part I'm seeing a lot of people I haven't seen for a lot of years. I get to Alaska fairly frequently, and I was in the Yukon five times last year, but I'm seeing people that I would not have seen except in my official capacity previously, and that's neat.
Well, don't be a stranger, you know. Oh, we'd love to have you back sometime.
Well, my terrible fear is I would come on your show and put thousands of Alaskans, rural Alaskans, to sleep listening to me express my very bland, my very bland Canadian views about things.
You were bland about the border. I will say that. Thank you so much, Tony Pennicutt.
A pleasure being here, Steve.
Week of the Arctic coming up next week on Talk of Alaska, ballot measure 2. Yes, that's right, coastal zone. Thanks very much to Dave Waldron at the controls, Josh Edge on the phone. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Providence Imaging Center with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology, provimaging.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Fall semester is just around the corner. Alaska Pacific University offers 2-year, 4-year, master and doctorate level programs committed to student-centered experiential learning. And there's no application deadline. Online education options are available in all undergraduate programs. For more information on how to obtain a quality and affordable education, visit alaskapacific.edu or call 564-8248. This message is sponsored by APU. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.